Good morning. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Monday, April 3rd, 2017. Colleagues, thank you for joining me as we open another public hearing on Senate Bill 5524, the continuing saga of the Higher Education Coordinating Committee budget bill. And today, I'm going to, even though Mr. Cannon is hiding a little bit out there in the audience, I'm still, I believe, going to call him up with some assortment of the other scheduled testifiers for today.
Madam Chair, just to remind you, I think we're on page about 164, and which you need to go back to the 27th of March to find the document.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Continuing saga. I like that. Just I'll first start again by noting the letter that we submitted on Friday. I believe it's on OLIS, that responds to some of the questions that arose on Thursday afternoon, some additional data related to OICC, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and the out-of-school youth we serve there, some of the college credits in high school, and average savings amounts that, in response to the question from Representative Wisnett. So please do let us or our staff know if you have any additional questions on any of those items. Just to remind the subcommittee on where we're at, we began with our introduction to higher education in Oregon, talked about affordability and the state programs for scholarships, the Opportunity Grant and the Promise, and other investments. Then we moved into this more sort of fluid section of transitions and pathways, which is really at the heart of the HECS work to help create a seamless higher education system for Oregonians. And we began with a focus on students coming to higher education from K-12, from the workforce, talked about some of the training investments that we make, investments related to out-of-school youth. We're going to continue that focus this morning, but then moving into transitions within higher education, and particularly from two-year to four-year schools. So we'll start with Patrick Crane. He'll introduce himself, talk about some of the continuing ways that we engage students who are coming from non-traditional or sort of outside the pipeline, so not directly from K-12 sources. And then we'll move on and look at those transitions within higher education. So with that, I'll turn it over to Patrick.
Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chair Smith, Mortar, and Monroe, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Crane. I'm the director of HECS Office of Community College and Workforce Development. As Ben said, we're still at the tail end now of the transitions into post-secondary education. So I spent some time with you on Thursday talking about secondary to post-secondary academic transitions. This morning I'll touch on three topics related to engagement outside the pipeline, so bringing Oregonians back into educational opportunity, specifically GED, adult basic education, credit for prior learning. This will take seven slides, and then we will turn it over to the next presenter. Looking first at the GED, the general education development, why is high school equivalency so important in Oregon? I think it's important to start off by noting that approximately 10% of adult Oregonians do not have a high school diploma. But when we look at it through the equity lens and start to disaggregate by different racial ethnic groups, for Hispanic Oregonians, the percentage is 39%. Without a high school diploma. So in the context of both 40-40-20 and the equity lens, this work is critically important. So what is HECS' role related to GED? The Oregon GED program is administered by HECS Office of Community College and Workforce Development. We work in partnership with GED Testing Services, Oregon 17 community colleges, and professionals at over 70 test prep locations across the state. In terms of funding, we receive funds from GED Testing Services that help support 1.5 positions in the office. We also received a $2 million allocation from the legislature in 2015, 1.6 of which has been distributed for wraparound services to support the test prep sites and others that are providing additional supports for students who are taking the GED. And we have approximately four people spread over 2.5 FTE in this area. And in terms of the grants that went out from this funding, we received 33 applications and we awarded 16 grants, ranging from a little over $8,000 to $150,000. And the recipients were community colleges, Oregon Department of Corrections, some nonprofit and community-based organizations, as well as an educational service district and Eastern Oregon University.
And I apologize if I missed this. The GED Summit, can you talk briefly about?
Yes, thank you.
What is done at that?
So the GED Summit, I think we've had it for 3 years now, and it's an opportunity for the GED community, particularly those who run test prep locations, offer GED testing services, to get together, talk about what's working, what's not working, and really provide a professional development opportunity for GED test takers. We've received some national recognition for this. The GED Testing Services National Office, they have come the last couple years and spoken very highly of the work that Oregon has been doing. Last year, we had a couple representatives from Washington State come down, so we intend to reach out again this year in order to expand the attendance so that we have more of a cross-state opportunity, because there's nothing like this in Washington State.
Okay. Thank you.
And just a quick look at who is taking the GED in Oregon. Again, these tend to be underserved individuals. Hispanics and multiracial Oregonians are overrepresented in this population. Most are unemployed, low-income, and male. So you're aware there are four GED tests, and in order to pass, you have to get a passing score on all four of them. The passing score was actually lowered from 150 to 145, I believe, last year, to be more in line with what college readiness actually is in a traditional high school. The American Council on Education has also taken a close look at the GED and what its scores are and what their equivalencies are, and they recommend that for scores upwards of 165, that students should be able to waive placement tests, waive developmental education, and in some cases receive additional credit in college for the work they're doing.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So help me understand. So a person comes in to take the GED. So as part of the services to prep, I'm just trying to understand, do they just walk in off the street and say, I want to take the GED? Or is there some prep that they get to go through first that helps them understand what the test is?
I think it varies a little bit by testing location, but I believe in general they can come in and say, I want to take the GED, and receive materials that they can take practice tests, they can take courses, they can receive additional supports for the exam.
Thank you.
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quickly for the committee members, and I think you obviously probably know this, but in our policy committee it came up that the military now, because they're getting so many volunteers, most of the military departments will not accept GED. Mm-hmm. So the people taking it or not, because they can be more selective and now ask for high school versus GED.
Moving on to adult basic education and literacy in Oregon, this is also referred to as Title II, and it's Title II in the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, formerly the Workforce Innovation Act. And HEC's office administers this federally funded program. And you'll hear later this morning from Karen Hummelbaugh, and she'll talk about Title I from the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, used to assist adults and dislocated workers. But the focus here is on providing literacy, numeracy, and English as a second language training for Oregonians. About $5 million in federal funds come to our office for this, most of which is distributed back to the 17 community colleges who currently have the contracts to deliver adult basic skills. They're required to provide a 25% match of either cash or in-kind for these services. We're in the middle of recompeting this right now. So the playing field will expand from only community colleges offering these to community-based organizations, and others will have the opportunity to provide adult basic education. This work employs five staff in the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, three full-time and a couple part-time staff to provide research or other administrative support.
And Can you talk about why you're expanding the population who can apply for this?
It's part of, I think it's a requirement for the change in federal legislation. The Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act requires a recompetition in order to allow more entities to provide these services.
Okay. And maybe to provide more culturally competent outreach and opportunity as well?
I think that can be a component, certainly. There's an extensive review process, most of which is set by the federal government. I could provide more information on what that looks like if it's desirable.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Looking at the population here as well, it's about 18,000 students a year, and this has been consistent over about the last 10 years. A mixture of urban and rural, mixture of employed, unemployed, and those not in the labor force. And in another committee, we received the question, is the state essentially double paying for high school students that didn't do well and are coming back into adult basic education services? Looking at the age demographics, that's not really the case. Almost half of them are between 25 and 44. So they may have exited traditional high schools at some point, realized they couldn't reach their career goals or educational aspirations, and are returning back to acquire the skills necessary to go on either in their career or in their education.
And I'm sorry, can I ask one more question about that? So is there like an end point? So with the GED, for example, you come in and you take the test and you either pass or you don't. In adult basic skills, what is the exit point?
So there are a couple of different metrics that we have to report on to the federal government to measure student success. Acquiring a GED is one of them. Finding a job, retaining employment, or continuing on in higher education in a certificate or degree program. So this is... it doesn't have a clearly demarcated endpoint the way the GED does, where you pass a test and then you move forward. But it's education in English, numeracy, English as a second language, occasionally, and in a growing proportion, also embedded within technical skills programs. Washington State has a program called iBEST, where rather than putting students directly into what could be remedial English or math with no connection to their career goals, you embed English and math skills within a career and technical field, which is generally what the student is wishing to pursue in the first place. So it can look at a number of different ways, and success is measured essentially, are they able to successfully go on either to employment or further education?
And I believe there's an iBEST program at Mountain Hood Community College.
I believe there is as well.
So would that be served by that? Is this the funding source for that program?
This would be one of the funding sources for that program.
Great. Thank you.
Finally, I'll just touch briefly on credit for prior learning. This is a responsibility of the HEC to form an advisory committee to look at credit for prior learning. And this is another way that students can receive post-secondary credit for work experience or education they've received outside of a college or university. This can include military credit, informal education, work experience, et cetera. And the HEC has their CPL, Credit for Prior Learning Advisory Committee, that reports annually to the legislature about progress towards increasing the number of students who receive academic credit for prior learning, as well as information on the types, how it affects transfer, et cetera.
Members of the committee, we're going to make a quick transition and ask Veronica Dujon to join me as we move into transfer pathways between institutions. So I've sort of foreshadowed the conversation that we'll have now that focuses on transfer pathways between, in particular, two-year and four-year schools. And Veronica can introduce herself.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee, representative, co-chairs, Senator Monroe, and Representative Smith Warner. For the record, my name is Veronica Dujon, and I'm Director for Academic Planning and Policy in the Public University Coordination Office at the HEC. As Ben indicated, today I will focus essentially on the transition out of the two-year system, the community colleges, into the four-year system, the public universities. In terms of the work that we do, we're heavily focused on policy and collaboration to smooth the student pathways across these two sectors. It's the work that we do is primarily supported by staff from the Office of Community College and Workforce Development and the public universities. We have about 4 staff people across these two sectors that focus on that work. And you will see in terms of the budget, it will appear in our final day of presentation. So why focus on transfer? There are significant reasons why we do that. The effort is to streamline that transfer pathway. But when we do look at the students who are affected, and we think from an equity lens, it's primarily students who are first generation or underserved student groups who stand to benefit from the work that we do on transfer. Nationally, when we look at the number of students who transfer, about 43% of them from the years 2008 to 2014, about 44% of them were actually transfer students, and of those, they tended to transfer 2 to 4 times. When we look at what that is like in Oregon itself, in 2013-14, 43% of newly admitted students to our public universities were transfer students. And in 2011-14, a little over half of them who actually got degrees were transfer students. So many Oregonians transfer from the community colleges to the public universities. And when we look at that number, it has generally trended upwards from some 4,000 in the year 2001 to about 6,300 in the most recent year that we have data for. In 2009-10, the most recent year we have substantial data, 72% of students from community colleges were moving into universities without actually earning their associate's degree. That means they were moving on before earning a degree, so that transfer pathway is quite significant.
Senator Monroe.
Yes, Veronica, we have the Oregon Promise now, but you don't have enough data, I'm sure, to tell whether it's making a difference, but I would imagine that that number will accelerate with the Oregon Promise.
Senator Monroe, members of the committee, yes, I think the expectation is that the numbers will be greater, although as you indicate, we do not have data yet to that extent.
And can I ask one other question about this? Does this track with the general population increase, or has it exceeded the number, the increase in transfer students? Is that kind of going along with the general increase in number of students, or does it exceed that?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I'm not sure, but this is information we can certainly get
Great.
To you.
Thank you.
So as I was indicating, a significant number, 72% of students in the 2009-10 academic year transferred out of community colleges into universities without actually earning an associate's degree. That means the process of transfer becomes all the more significant because the expectation is that they will get all the required credits and graduate with a 4-year degree when they've left the public universities. One of the interesting things that has happened, however, beginning back in October of 2012, there was an effort of some 10 community colleges and all of the 7 public universities to begin a reverse transfer effort. So students who would actually get into a university without having completed an associate's degree could actually get those degrees at the university and earn an associate's degree even while at the 4-year institution. The potential impact is significant enough that our data suggests that if all students who were eligible to get their 2-year degrees did, we would increase the number of associates we have by some 10%. What we know is that we estimate about half of the students, however, lose some credits in that transfer process, and that's a significant challenge. When we look at it from the perspective of students who are leaving the community colleges, 54% of these students are estimated to have entered the universities with fewer credits than they earned at the community colleges. And of those students who are transferring, 26% of these transfer students are estimated to have lost more than one term of work when they arrive or at their careers in the four-year institution. So the credits are not all moving with them.
Mr. Representative Lively.
Thank you. So I'd be curious as to, because there's a significant number, the total number of people in community college is huge. And I understand they take a lot of different courses. And all I can recount to is when I started this whole process, I was a transfer student at the community college. I'd be interested to know, given that number that we say are transferring, how many actually start off at the community college and transfer with their intent to do that but don't, because it doesn't seem like 6,000 is a very significant number, at least in the near term. I'm just wondering, of those that think they're going to, do we have some way of knowing how many don't?
Representative Lively, co-chairs, we'll do our best to follow up. One of the challenges, you've really pinpointed it, is understanding student intent at the community college level. There is some survey work, both nationally and in Oregon, that suggests, in ways that this data maybe doesn't, the actual intent of students, so that you could compare, for example, the 6,000 transfers to how many might have intended, how many community college students might have intended to do so. But to be clear, that is imprecise, in part likely because student intent at the outset is also, for some, imprecise.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you. And if I may continue. So the majority of robust transfer students, and these are students who would have been admitted based on their GPA and would have required some 24 to 36 of their credits at community college. For those students, they transfer, but they do not complete at the same rates as the direct entry students do. So students who would have started at the universities and gone through. So there is a disparity. The 82% of students who entered as direct entry into the four-year institutions graduate, and only about 62.4% of the community college students do. So here we would like to focus on three areas of work that we're doing in terms of the challenges that we see and how they could be addressed. There is the mobility and portability of credits issue. There is the information and resources and systems to aid the students. And there's the area of successful transfer and application of credits and how that affects affordability and completion.
Senator Roblin?
Go back to the previous show, if you could. So do we track how many credits they lose, those that transfer, non-transfer, so they didn't finish their degree, right, but they transferred to a higher education institution, and those that are transfer students, the percentage of their courses that transferred in each one of them, do we keep track of that? Because, I mean, it may be that people are selectively choosing classes that are going to transfer for them, but it doesn't give them a degree, so there's a higher transfer rate of courses in that 82% group than there is in the 62% group. It would be interesting to know.
Thank you for the question, Senator Roblin. Co-chairs, members of the committee, that is certainly information we can try to get back to you on, but as I think Ben has indicated, actually tracking students and matching across these two sectors
really
is
hard.
Quite a challenge.
Yeah.
And we do our best to figure out how many of the credits that the students earn at the community colleges and how many show up on their transfer once they've gotten there. But we do not always get the perspective from the universities about how many credits they award.
Follow up.
Please.
Yeah, because I just want to say, I think schools in both the community college and in K-12 are working harder at trying to make sure that students who enter into community colleges pick courses which they know will transfer. So there may be something working against getting your transfer degrees based on that information, and that would be bad from my perspective. So thanks.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. And there is some more data or information
okay.
we will present as we discuss the challenges. So in terms of mobility and portability of credits, students do lose ground every time they transfer. And The interesting thing is the transfer costs and credit applicability to institution and programs is a greater issue than just the transfer of credits itself. So there has to be alignment according to the disciplines and the needs that students have. Students can transfer with credits, but they may not necessarily apply to their majors, and so they may end up with excess credits. We also have, in terms of the information resources that are available to students and to help them along figuring out that pathway, we think more in terms of a maze rather than a pathway because it's a confusing array of variable requirements for similar degrees, articulation agreements that exist, and the applicability of coursework across the public universities. So it is one issue from the community college to the public universities. Across public universities itself, we also see there are some challenges. And so we have a lack of a common statewide transfer information system that all our students can link into for good information. And the third area of challenge is the successful transfer and application of credits and how that affects affordability and completion. Because the students who actually move from a community college into a four-year institution, it is with the intent of getting a bachelor's degree. But along the way, the challenges they face in terms of applying their credits or actually playing for courses means they actually, many of them leave without actually getting a degree and in the process accumulate debt without actually having a degree. But there is a substantial amount of work that we do at the HEC in terms of collaboration and convening across these sectors, as well as smoothing and aligning these pathways. In terms of the collaboration work and the convening work that we do, we work with our partners, and we have developed recommendations and research on these pathways through House Bill 2525 report that we worked on, and we are continuing to engage in transfer and articulation policy through the Joint Transfer Articulation Committee. We collaborate with institutions to improve initiatives such as the Interstate Passport that actually creates a block of courses that each institution designates as having met lower division general education credits. Once the students have that passport, they can move from one institution to another without disaggregating the courses that fill and make up that passport. We also have a technical work group to study and make recommendations for a robust statewide transfer student information system, and funding to develop and maintain that system has not yet been secured, so it's a work in progress.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Representative Wisdom, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Veronica, I haven't looked at this for a couple of years, but there was an effort in Europe to have transferability across nations in Europe. Have you followed that or seen how that's doing?
Representative Wisnett, co-chairs of the committee and committee members, I am not familiar with that particular effort, but we certainly can look into it. In many ways, the Interstate Passport, which was an effort of the Western Interstate Consortium on Higher Ed, was intended to be really for those states that are part of the consortium, but it has been successful enough that it has gone national. States outside of that consortium are also participating. So I would...
Thank you for that response. I'll try to find my reference to it, because there is a program, I think, in Europe. I forgot what it's called.
Thank you.
And can I ask quickly, that Interstate Passport, is that, so I would assume that the transfer associates, and I'm not remembering the name correctly, that you get from the community colleges, that is a kind of two-year chunk that is applicable to many four-year degrees within the Oregon higher ed system. Does that fall under the Interstate Passport as well? Or does it qualify, I guess?
Representative Smith-Warner, not exactly. There are some, although the intent is the same, but there is greater degrees of freedom in the Interstate Passport for each institution to decide based on the outcomes that are achieved from the courses taught, whether or not they fulfill the expectations for lower division, the lower division credits. So it allows each of the universities and the community colleges to decide on an individual basis when students have met these lower division credits and how to populate which courses that will fit in the passport.
Okay. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up to Veronica. I'd suggest you look at the University of Maryland's transfer policy. They have a reputation for being the best accepting other, I don't know what their policies or how their guidance. I know a lot of that's due to contracts they have with the U.S. military, but their transferability policy is tops as far as accepting other college courses, I think. Thank you.
Thank you for that recommendation, Representative Wisnett. We certainly will follow up with it. If I may continue, in terms of smoothing and aligning pathways, we have been working with our stakeholders to reassess and realign the statewide transfer degrees, as we were just discussing, the AAOT and the ASOT, which are not currently functioning as we had expected they would. They're not as efficient as we had thought they would be. We are also very much collaborating with the deans and the colleges of education leaders and community colleges who are creating an education pathway for community college students to enter the teaching profession. So here we have a professional school that's working quite closely across the sectors to ensure that these transfer pathways are as smooth as they could be. We are also working on the Transfer Student Bill of Rights and Responsibilities, and that is expected to be established and adopted by the HEC by December 31st, 2018. And by fall 2019, we are working on a process for community colleges and universities to align the most popular transfer majors statewide, and every year subsequent to that, we expect more majors will come online.
And could I, so the AAOT and the ASOT, is that what I was trying to come up? So, and can you tell me what the OT stands for in both of those?
Oregon Transfer.
Thank you.
So it's, yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about, given that that is what they were designed to do, why isn't it working? I realize that's probably a bigger question, but...
There have been challenges, Representative Chair Smith-Warner. There have been challenges in terms of aligning as closely as possible with the majors of the disciplines. So although these degrees were meant to be a package for the arts and a package for the sciences, individual science majors, for example, might require a different undergraduate a course to align with, say, chemistry or biology that the ASOT may not have. So in some ways, although the intent was to anticipate what these requirements might be, depending on what majors the students are interested in, the alignment is not as good or not as clear as it could have been because of these changes or shifts in what the lower division requirement would be for a particular major.
So is it 80% working and we're having trouble with 20%? Is it 50% working and we're having trouble with the other half? I don't know that you have a number, but I'm just trying to get a sense of the scope of the problem.
Representative Smith-Warner, co-chair Monroe, and members of the committee, you're right. We are still trying to figure out from our data how to what extent we have a problem. But as we think about going forward and how to work on the transfer pathway and improving the alignment, we are including the work and building on the work that has already been done with the AAOT and the ASOT. So the work will show up as we move forward.
Okay, thank you. Senator Roblin?
So along that same line, have we looked at the state of Washington and how they align their courses? Because as a transfer student in that state, I didn't even think this was an issue. Every one of my, I was a math major, and I changed my majors two or three times. Started out as biology, went to another person. None of my my undergraduate courses from my community college were ever at risk of not being accepted. So I don't, this is one that since I can't come to Oregon, I've never been able to quite grasp. So I would just say maybe look at Washington and see why they don't seem to have this problem, because their universities seem to do just as well as our universities with respect to kids graduating with degrees. So anyway, I would just see what, it just drives me crazy. Yes.
Okay, Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I hate when people say, well, when I was in school, but this astounds me too, because I attended a community college the first 2 years the community college existed, and I had zero problem transferring all of my credits to the University of Oregon in my major, or even changing my major. And so it baffles me how this day and age we've come this far, and yet from my perspective, from what I've seen in that, we're worse off than we were when we started this process. I don't know.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I can assure you that Veronica didn't speak to our Higher Education Policy Committee, but I think Director Cannon confirmed that this committee just doesn't understand this either, this transferability, why it takes so long and why we can't move further and wider. The director can remember that he helped me develop my $10,000 degree bill, which we changed, which was Florida and Texas, but we changed it to affordable degree, and it talked about pathways, and that was two sessions ago. So Veronica, if you haven't looked at that one, but we tried to actually, presidents came up with some responses to that bill that were interesting. But the transferability is just, it's, I think it's really killing us. It's just, there's too many students now that don't start the same school and graduate there. The mobility of our society, everything, we have to move this faster. I know we're trying, Director. I know that there's all sorts of task force, and I'm sorry I haven't met Veronica before, and I'm glad we have someone looking at this, focusing on this issue. But we just need someone to say, do it.
Did you want to comment before I go to
just,
Senator Rubin?
Just briefly, to note that, as Representative Wisnant knows, there is a bill in the House Higher Education and Workforce Committee that addresses this very issue. Should that bill come out of that committee, it will likely come to this committee for further consideration in the budget context.
Senator Rubin?
Yeah, so we have a Senate bill also that has to do with a little bit of it, but it frustrates me because it talks about, I think they have identified 240-some pathways for kids that go through the system. And I'm thinking, as a high school senior, how do I pick from 200-and-some different pathways? If I pick this pathway and stay with it for 4 years, I'm going to get through. But very few kids start and finish the same program they started. So I just, those are the other parts of the issue. So I don't know. I know you've been working on it, because anybody that's identified 243 pathways obviously is thinking about it a lot.
Go ahead.
Thank you, members, and we really do look forward to the discussion or further discussion of this particular issue, which is at the heart of much of Veronica's work, and the commission has placed a real emphasis around. I think with that, we will shift gears and focus now on the work that the HEC does relative to our private post-secondary institutions. This is the point in the presentation where I would ordinarily be joined by Juan Baez Arevalo, who, in addition to being the interim director of our Office of Student Access and Completion, is also the ongoing director of our private post-secondary office. Juan, however, this week is in the annual national convening of state regulators for private post-secondary education in Kentucky. They are meeting with federal officials and his counterparts in other states. So I'm going to do my best. I may have to defer or deflect any questions to follow up. But this is a discrete office within the HEC that has a few primary functions, which I'll get into in a moment. Our private post-secondary work, the budget aspect of that will be focused, will be described on the final day where we describe our integrated agency budget. But just to note at the outset, this office, which Juan leads, receives no general funds and is entirely funded by federal contracts and fees from institutions. What are we talking about here? We're talking about private education in Oregon that contributes very significantly to our higher education goals. We noted this on our introductory day, but there are at least 21,000 total degrees and certificates awarded by Oregon private institution of higher education in 2015-16. We've divided them here according to one form of kind of disaggregating, which are degree-granting schools on the left-hand side, the 14,000, and then private career schools that offer trade-oriented certificates on the right-hand side. In terms of student enrollment, this is not a complete count, but again, nearly 60,000 total students enrolled. You see more of the degree breakdown there that results in the 21,424. Who are these students? Well, again, our data, our understanding of data from the sector is less complete than it is of the from the public's, not surprisingly, but it is also improving, and we can report based on the three quarters from whom we have data today that 42% of those students are between the ages of 22 and 34. These certificates and degrees earned at private post-secondary institutions in Oregon confer value to students. These are average degree earnings or average earnings 1 year after certificate or degree completion. Again, this is a very high-level average aggregate of students, a variety of students coming from a variety of institutions, but it does reflect the earnings impact that certificate and degree attainment at these institutions have. And keep in mind, this is after just a single year in the workforce.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Ben, when I was on a board of a private college, Warner Pacific, for 15 years, the assumption, I think, among most people was that the students were more affluent or came from a more affluent background than those that went to our public institutions. And actually, I saw data that that's not the case, that the demographic at schools, private institutions like Warner Pacific, is virtually identical to the demographic at most of our public universities. Which tells me that the private institutions that we have are critical, provide a very important service, and in fact supplement the whole education system in the state of Oregon, and that without them, or without, you know, of course the issue is always, well, do you give any public support to private institutions? And we do some. But without those private institutions, making up that gap would be very, very difficult and expensive.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I think that's a important point. Keep in mind when I'm describing at this point private institutions in Oregon, it runs the gamut. So we've got institutions like Willamette University across the street, George Fox, where I'll be later today, the Institute of Technology, a degree-granting institution in Salem that's very career and trade-focused, private career schools that offer certificates in cosmetology, in tax preparation, in bicycle repair and mechanics. So it's at a general level a very diverse sector, but also at a general level it employs or it enrolls demographically a diverse range of Oregonians, to be sure. Our key responsibilities are really in three categories. One is actually work that we do via federal contract on behalf, essentially, of the VA, where the state, through our office and one FTE, ensures that post-secondary programs, apprenticeships, and on-the-job trainings in Oregon are quality programs for veterans and their dependents for the purpose of qualifying for GI Bill benefits. This actually involves the publics as much as it does the privates. We, through this FTE, certify their eligibility, the eligibility of their students to apply their GI benefits to those schools. Our Office of Degree Authorization, a component of the private post-secondary unit, focuses on the regulation and oversight of degree-granting, non-exempt private institutions in Oregon. And then the Private Career Schools Division unit focuses on our certificate-granting schools, private career schools, and the oversight and regulation of them. Just a little more detail about each of those three pieces of work. We approve these hundreds of facilities in Oregon for GI Bill benefits. You see here the list, everything from our public universities and OHSU, our community colleges, our degree granting and certificate granting private institutions, flight schools, apprenticeships, and on-the-job training. And again, this involves applying the federal standards, essentially auditing, overseeing those institutions to make sure that they're following the requirements that are established in federal law. The Office of Degree Authorization, or ODA, this again is our focus on the degree granting schools. To note here, and it's really at the bottom of the slide, there are private degree-granting schools in Oregon that are exempt from this, the application of our regulatory oversight, by virtue of being nonprofit and regionally accredited. So Warner Pacific, for example, that the co-chair mentioned, or Willamette, or Reed, or Pacific, are exempt. They're members of an Oregon institution, Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges. So they're the, in a way, what many members likely have on their mind when they hear private post-secondary. That's the 23 in the bottom box that enroll 37,000 students. Our regulatory focus is on the 17 nonprofit and 7 for-profit private institutions that don't meet that statutory exemption of being nonprofit and regionally accredited. And those institutions include the Art Institute of Portland, the Oregon College of Oriental Medicine, et cetera. The private career schools unit, it approves, evaluates, and approves licenses for private career schools. There are 173 of them licensed in the state, offering 998 certificate programs. They're located in all corners of the state and offer a wide variety of program offerings. You see here some of the examples: bookkeeping, computer technology, hair stylist, aesthetics, line worker, phlebotomy, truck driving, mechanics. These are typically Oregon-owned small businesses that we have a licensure role towards. We get significantly involved when or if there are closures in this sector. So you can imagine being a student at a school where you come to find out on Sunday night that the school is going to close on Monday. What do? Well, you come to the HAC because we, in a sense, inherit responsibility for the at least some of the records and the well-being of students who are enrolled in the academic well-being of students who are enrolled in a private career school or regulated degree-granting school when and if it closes. This is an industry that has undergone a certain amount of contraction over the last couple of years, and as a result, our staff has dealt with a number of these closures. You see the 13 private career schools closures, or actually 21 between 2015 and 16, and then some significant and high-profile closures of degree-granting schools between 2015 and 17. These occur in different ways. Some of them are very planned and intentional, such as the teach-out process at Le Cordon Bleu and the University of Phoenix. Others are much more abrupt, such as the September 2016 closure of ITT Tech.
And that closure really was troubling to many of us, and certainly to our students. But fortunately, some of the other institutions were able to pick up those students and give them, protect the work that they had already accomplished and allow them to be moving forward with their training.
Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, for the next couple of slides, give examples of the ways in which we help to support that kind of ongoing education for students in the event of closure. You see on this slide the sort of regulatory and consumer protection role that we play, working with the federal agencies, the Attorney General's Office, bankruptcy trustees, et cetera, to help deal with the aftermath of a school closure. Put ourselves in the role of kind of consumer protection, providing up-to-date resources and information to students, particularly on their financial options. Tuition money can be at stake, in some cases prepaid tuition money, and we'll see that on the subsequent slide here. Academic transitions, which sort of speaks to the point that Senator Monroe made, where we attempt to secure for students, particularly when it's a planned closure, secure, clear academic transfer pathways for students who are partway through their degree. So this involves coordinating with institutions, public and private. In the case of ITT Tech, which was abrupt, we were particularly focused on nursing students for whom there was not a clear there weren't spaces in existing nursing programs And many of these students were close to receiving their nursing degrees. So with terrific support from PCC, whose president was or is in the room today, and the legislature, we were able to, in effect, broker a teach-out agreement, teach-out arrangement for those ITT Tech nursing students at Portland Community College. And finally, the financial side of the equation, our office, through statutory provision, administers a tuition protection fund for students in private career schools. That's a fund that the schools themselves pay into. And in the event of a school closure, students who have paid tuition are effectively refunded that tuition out of the fund. So we administer that fund. On the degree granting side, so not private career schools now, but regulated degree granting institutions, again, under statutory provision, we secure surety bonds or letters of credit to provide students with refunds, again, of prepaid tuition in the event that a school closes before they've completed courses that they have paid for. So this is
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Cochere. So I'm a little, the teach out, I'm not quite clear on what that, is that only in circumstances where the school has closed, or I'm just a little, I don't clearly understand what that means.
Representative Lively, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. So teach out is a term that describes the teaching of a program that is the teaching of a program to its conclusion for students who are currently enrolled when that program is ending. So most often this occurs when a school decides to end a program, mm-hmm. and they teach it out, meaning all students who are currently enrolled in it have the right to finish their certificate or degree before the program is ended. In some cases, and this is the way I've been using it, when a school itself closes, we attempt to secure a teach-out option at another school. In effect, Portland Community College is teaching out the final terms of an ITT Tech program that they've sort of brought on board, brought some of the faculty and the curriculum on board in order to teach it to its conclusion. It won't be a permanent ongoing program for new students, but they will permit those who were enrolled in it at the time of ITT Tech's closure to complete.
Thank you.
With that, Mr. Chair, we will conclude our focus on the private post-secondary institutions and the critical role that they play in Oregon higher education, and we will turn to the ways in which the Commission, through our Office of Workforce Investment, helps students transition to career success, helps Oregonians transition, not just students, Oregonians generally, achieve greater levels of career success and meet industry needs.
Great. Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, my name is Karen Hummelbaugh. I am the Director of the Office of Workforce Investments at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We've been focusing on the colleges and university and post-secondary school programs and how they prepare folks to be successful in transitioning to careers. We're going to shift gears just a little bit to focus on the public workforce system. In particular, this system is required through our federal legislation, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, to partner with a variety of federal titles, which include our partners at the Oregon Employment Department, the Department of Human Services, Self-Sufficiency and Vocational Rehabilitation Programs, the Oregon Commission for the Blind and the Bureau of Labor and Industries to serve adults, dislocated workers, and youth and businesses. And slide. And just quickly, you'll see some more about the budget as we as Ben talks next week. But this is primarily a federally funded program, but we do have an investment of general funds in the GRB. It is down about 9% from the LAB, and there are two FTE dedicated to these funds. I'll talk about the strategies in these funds in just a moment. This chart is something that hopefully looks familiar from earlier last week that Ben showed you, but I want to draw your attention to the bottom two left green boxes. We do have two governing committees or boards over the workforce system in this state. One is the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. The other is the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps Advisory Committee that I talked to you about last Thursday. Both of those oversee the work that we do in the Office of Workforce Investments, and you'll see on the far right that the delivery system is through the 9 local workforce development boards throughout the state, as well as the grantees for the summer and school year programs for the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps.
The workforce system serves two primary customers. One is Oregon businesses. The other is individual Oregonians. The goal is to provide the business and industry individuals with talent that they need in order to succeed, and then to assure that individuals have the skills they need so that they can earn good wages and progress in their careers. You'll see a variety of services here that are offered through the workforce system. Most of these services are delivered primarily in Oregon's 37 WorkSource Oregon centers. Individuals are given assistance with what we would call workforce readiness skills primarily. These are things like resume writing, interviews, job search, how are you looking for and deciding what career you're going to have, as well as gaining some kind of industry recognized credential or training. Businesses are assisted with primarily the convening of like industry partners, so sitting down with others in their industry and looking at like needs for their talent, looking at work-based learning opportunities such as internships, apprenticeships, and on-the-job training, as well as sending them in the direction of tax credits or worksite adaptations for those needing accommodations. Our system is governed, as I mentioned, by the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. This is a business majority oversight board. They're responsible for providing feedback to the local boards as well as the workforce agencies, and they assure accountability and performance. As part of their role, they also recommend policies to the governor. And I've included a hyperlink here so that you can see who serves on that group, and as well as if you'd like to look at their performance dashboard. The Workforce Board recently started a five-year strategic plan. It has four main components, four goals, the first of which is all about system alignment, making sure that we have an integrated system with good handoffs for individuals as they work their way through the system. The second is really about how our system serves our business customer, making sure they have the talent pipeline they need. The third goal is all about our adult and dislocated worker customers, making sure that they have skills for high-wage jobs and career progression. And the fourth goal I talked more about last week, but is really about how do we make sure that young people have both the information and the experiences they need in order to connect to jobs and careers. All of these goals are keeping in mind an emphasis on our often left behind Oregonians in our rural communities, our families experiencing multi-generational poverty, and our communities of color. As I mentioned, these are delivered through the state, the nine local workforce development boards. They have a variety of required roles and responsibilities through the federal act, but they are primarily responsible for delivery of the strategic plan in their areas. And the biggest role they have is in providing the convening table for all of the workforce conversations in their communities. They leverage all of the resources and assist with delivering these outcomes by brokering the conversations at that table. The following is a map of the nine areas, and just so that you can see the breadth and the areas that are covered, this is an attempt to be able to talk about individual economies versus assuming that things in the southeastern side of the state are the same as the metro area. It allows localization of delivery of services. We have targeted strategies to serve our adults. Again, many of them have to do with experiential learning, hands-on work experience combined with classroom training. We achieve this through a number of ways, including paid or for credit internships and apprenticeships, and also in industry-recognized certifications and credentials. I'm going to talk about four of our state-funded initiatives in that bucket that I mentioned earlier, the first of which is our National Career Readiness Certificate Program, or the NCRC. This is a certificate brought to us by the folks at the American College Testing, or ACT. We generally think of them as the college entrance exams, but they did a number of years ago go out and profile tens of thousands of businesses across the country in a variety of industries. They looked at the jobs and occupations, and then they decided what were the critical skills that were needed in all of those jobs and occupations that crossed over. And there are three main areas in which they clustered those: applied mathematics, applied reading, and locating information. And those, so the test consists of those three groupings. And we have about 61,000 Oregonians to date who've received this certificate. And when we look at the data of all of our customers in the workforce system compared to those receiving their NCRCs, we notice increases in all of the things that we believe indicate success, which is really, did you get a job? Are you earning more than when you came to us on that first day? And are you keeping that job over time? And you'll see that they have increases in placement wages and retention higher than the cohort. The second initiative is linked to the National Career Readiness Certificate, and this is the ACT Certified Work Ready Communities. This is an initiative that really focuses on economic development, and it's a way in which a community can describe what their talent looks like. And so in order to work on economic growth in a community, this is one way in which they can demonstrate with a certification what the talent is in their county. A county has to show that they have a particular number of individuals in emerging workforce, incumbent, and in their dislocated workers that have received the NCRC. We currently have 12 counties in the state that are certified work ready. Douglas, Jefferson, and Wasco were the latest to join that designation. The third of our state-funded initiatives is the Back to Work Oregon program. This is our agency's primary on-the-job training program. It's a hire first program. It pays the wages for an employee who's received a job for 4 to 6 weeks while they're receiving the additional company-specific training that they need in order to succeed. This is the third biennium for this program, and for each of the state OJTs, we match it with a federally funded OJT. During the first two biennia, we enrolled nearly 4,000 Oregonians who were successful in their OJTs. It looks like we will add another almost 3,000 to that at the end of this biennia. And when compared again to our general pool, you can see that their results are much higher with that on-the-job experiential learning and those extra skills they get with their employers, particular to the wages and retention being significantly higher. The fourth and final initiative is more of a philosophy or an approach to doing our business, and that really is about assisting industry and businesses in solutions that will help them succeed. This is more about the engagement with those business and industries instead of assuming that we have all their answers because we have these magical programs that we've determined are really great and going in and selling those. We go in and talk to folks who are in an industry and ask them what their biggest needs are. Sometimes they are workforce needs and talent needs, and other times they might be something about taxes or regulation or transport. What we do is we sit down and the local boards actually convene these tables, and they are able to decide what are those locally driven and determined solutions that meet those industry needs so that they can grow. Again, this is an interdependent versus independent approach, and it really is not about one individual business over another, but about what are those industry needs as a collective. If you look at the following slide, you'll see, based on the 9 local workforce areas, where they are focusing their time in these sector strategies. They are required through their local plans to have at least 2. Many of them have more. You'll notice that there are similarities regardless of where you are around the state. Some of those are industry sector strategies in healthcare or advanced manufacturing or information technology. But you'll notice that the idea of having those locally determined strategies shows up in things like the emerging maritime sector strategy on the coastal areas and the specialty ag partnership that is happening down in the Klamath Lake region. And to wrap up this section, I just wanted to share with you, I mentioned a few as we went through, but the measures of success for our adult and dislocated worker population really is about, did you get a job? Did you keep your job? And are you earning more than when you came to us? We also look at credential attainment in a variety of ways, as well as skills gain. And we offer certifications such as the National Career Readiness Certificate and the on-the-job training program, and measure it in terms of wages, retention, and placement.
So with that, co-chairs, we are at a stopping point for today. I hope today of all days has reminded you of the breadth of the work that occurs under the auspices of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We're scheduled to be back on Wednesday with our introduction to community colleges, and then you'll hear from the community colleges and their representatives directly. So we're going to take a focused look at that sector and the state investment in community colleges.
Colleagues, any other questions? Okay. Thank you so much, Mr. Cannon,
and
your many colleagues.
Co-chair.
Yes. So I'm going to go ahead and close today's public hearing on Senate Bill 5524. Tomorrow we will be taking public testimony on community colleges?
No, everything you've heard up to this point.
Gotcha. So affordability.
Oregon Promise,
et cetera.
Pathways.
Great. And we will be in F?
Actually, I think we'll try to do it here.
Oh,
we'll have
okay.
a backup room next door or okay. overflow.
Great. So we will see you all here tomorrow promptly at 8:30 for testimony. And with that, today's meeting is adjourned. Is adjourned. With that, today's meeting.